Welcome to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. This week, we preview the latest podcast from AZPM. Sports leaves an indelible mark on our society. Its impact runs the gamut from cultural touchstone to economic driver, and in that area are stories of struggle and triumph. That's the idea behind AZPM's podcast More Than a Game, which debuted its second season last week. So we're bringing you two stories from that episode, which featured the stories of two Tucson natives who ended up at their sport's highest levels. More Than a Game host Tony Perkins has the first story.
In and one another had to back off. Accordion effect, stacked them up. Everybody had to lift.
It's February 19th in Daytona, Florida, and Alex Bowman is at the doorstep of history at NASCAR's biggest race.
Here he comes, Kevin.
Ross Chastain leading the outside lane.
One lap to go, sponsored by Credit One
He's
Bank,
blocked,
and away they go.
That is Cindric into Chastain and up into traffic.
A crash late in the Daytona 500 left him running in second place, crossing the finish line just behind the winner, William Byron.
It's going to be close.
You see the light on, you see Bowman ahead of Byron right there, but need to back it up and see this again.
To be that close to a Daytona 500 is a little bit heartbreaking for sure, but it's much worse to not have a shot at all at it, right?
The race winner will be the 24. We'll need the 24 to start finish line.
Bowman climbed into his first race car when he was 7 years old. Now, at the age of 30, the Tucsonan is a Daytona 500 legend. He holds the record for the most consecutive front row starts and is tied for the second most starts from the pole in the Super Bowl of stock car racing, which has been held every February since 1959.
200 laps, 500 miles to start the 2024 season. Green flag, the Daytona 500 is underway.
Bowman drives a Chevrolet Camaro, specially built to run the NASCAR circuit. It's almost the same kind of car you can buy for the street, except Bowman's circles the 2.5-mile Daytona track at 186 miles an hour. Alex Bowman is the number one active professional athlete born and raised in the old Pueblo. I spoke to him a few weeks before the 2024 Daytona Classic, and we talked about his childhood in Tucson and what drew him to driving a race car.
Growing up, my dad was just a big NASCAR fan. Specifically, he was a big Jeff Gordon fan, and somehow he knew that when Jeff started racing, he started racing a car called a quarter midget, which is kind of like a go-kart. They race on small ovals, and coincidentally, there was a quarter midget track being built in Tucson. I don't think it was finished yet when my dad kind of showed up at home with a quarter midget, but kind of took off from there. Raced those from the time I was 7 to 13, I think. There are like different divisions of quarter midget racing, and they start off slow, right? And they get a lot faster kind of as you go. And I remember the first time I drove the fastest division, like thinking that it was like the fastest thing ever. That's like, out of everything I've ever raced, I remember like that's the car that stands out to me as feeling the fastest, which is crazy because obviously I've raced cars that are way faster than that. But I was probably 9 or 10 years old at that point. And just thinking it was crazy fast, which was super fun.
That's interesting because I've talked to other drivers who are professionals, and they talk about the fact that, of course, that way before they ever got any kind of driver's license to drive a car like the rest of us do, they had been driving in a race car for maybe 5 years or 6 years, in your case, almost 10 years. And a racing background before you would get into a passenger car or anything like that. Do you remember in Tucson just where this was, where this track was located? Was it a dirt track? Was it paved?
Yeah, so it's a pavement track. It's still there. I want to say it's like I-10 and Cortero Farms. I raced there, and then we started traveling to California quite a bit to race, kind of up and down California. And then as it progressed further, like, traveled all over the country. I remember 1 week, we had a big race in California one weekend, and the next weekend we had a big race in New Jersey. So it was like you raced in California, then road tripped across country and raced in New Jersey. I was super fortunate to meet a lot of pretty influential people along the way at a really young age. You know, the first development deal I signed came a lot later, but really started off by meeting Joe Custer, who was running Stuart Haas Racing at the time, because his son Cole was racing quarter midgets. He's a bit younger than me and kind of got started there. But, you know, if I hadn't made that connection when I was super young and racing quarter midgets, like I never would have gotten a break to move to North Carolina, and my career never would have gone where it went.
Okay, so now you guys are traveling from one side of the country to the other, different tracks, different events, that kind of thing. You know, say you're a teenager now and you get an opportunity and maybe a big, big break.
Yeah, so I kind of moved up from quarter midgets to racing midgets, like full-size race car, really fast. I had my own car, but also driving for some other people here and there. Raced Manzanita in Phoenix quite a bit and was kind of out of nowhere. Joe Custer called and was like, we're going to start a little development deal, build a shop in Charlotte, kind of separate from the Cup shop. And do you want to move to North Carolina and you know, continue racing midgets, but race it out of the shop in North Carolina and kind of run a more national program. And I think it was the middle of junior year. So I was 16 at the time. And I was like, of course I was going to say yes to that. So I had a little Chevy Cobalt and I packed up all my stuff in a Cobalt and I moved to North Carolina. Obviously, it takes a lot of things to go right to make it in racing, like especially to make it to the Cup Series. There's 36 of us now that run full time, and there's thousands of really talented race car drivers across the country. So took a lot of things to go right, and that was definitely one of them.
When you get that development deal, you know, you're sort of thrown into a group with other drivers. Are you still racing against some of those guys now?
Yeah, I mean, so Cole Custer was a part of that, obviously, and he went on to, he won the Xfinity Championship last year. So he ran Cup full-time for a little bit as well. So, you know, when I was racing midgets, Kyle Larson was coming on. He started racing midgets kind of like as I was getting out of it and getting into stock cars more. But yeah, so still race with a bunch of those guys today. And, you know, I've known Cole since I was probably 10 when I met him, 10 or 11. I met like Sheldon Creed, super young, quarter midget racing, kind of the same deal. So yeah, it's really cool to see kids I grew up with have success as well.
Let's switch over to Daytona. Was it one of your career goals to sit on the pole at Daytona? You've done it more than once now.
Daytona 500 qualifying is pretty interesting. It's much more the race car than the driver. Like the driver can really only mess that one up. So I've just been super fortunate to have a lot of really fast race cars down there. Driving for Hendrick Motorsports at Daytona. Hendrick Engine Shop's phenomenal. You know, with the old car, the Fab Shop, I mean, they're all in on the Speedway cars. Obviously, the next gen car is a little bit different, but we've been on the front row every year since I've been at Hendrick Motorsports. And I think we've been on the pole 3 times now. So yeah, really, really neat to be a part of it. And obviously, like I do all the media for it and I do like the pole award and all that, but it's really the people and the effort that gets put in back at the shop. So I'm just, I'm glad I get to drive it. And obviously it's a goal, like everybody wants that trophy, but yeah, it's hard to take much credit for it. I'm just glad I'm the guy that's gotten to do it for the last couple of years.
And of course, it's a fact that winning the pole at Daytona is one thing, but winning the race is another one. How much are you looking forward to actually getting into victory lane at Daytona?
You know, I think last year we finished 5th or 6th, which was a huge improvement over the last couple of years. So yeah, hopefully we can get the job done this year. It's just really hard to make it to the end of that race. You know, we've led a lot of laps, crashed early, we've crashed late, kind of figured out every time to crash until last year. So it's just it's a difficult event. It's a marathon for sure. And it gets so intense at the end that I feel like a lot of people end up getting crashed. Like a lot of people in contention to win that race get crashed. So trying to get to the end is crucial. And I feel like we figured out how to do that last year. Hopefully we can be a couple spots better this year.
You are probably the most accomplished professional athlete to come out of Tucson in a long time. But you're really not that well known because your sport is not one of the top stick and ball sports out there. Is it any different when you come back to Arizona and race in Phoenix?
Yeah, it's always super cool to be in Phoenix and see kind of the hometown crowd, obviously 100 miles away, but it's still super neat. There's a lot of great race car drivers come out of Arizona that I feel like don't get the recognition they deserve or maybe are a bit forgotten and shouldn't be. But I think I was the first person from Arizona to win a cup race. So that was really neat. Just got to keep winning a bunch more and the rest will take care of itself.
Alex Bowman, thank you very much. Really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Alex Bowman drives a stock car for Hendrick Motorsports. He has inherited the mantle worn by modern NASCAR greats like Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson. Bowman turns 31 years old in April, and in 2025, he will drive again at Daytona and make another attempt to win the great American race.
You're listening to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. We're previewing the latest season of AZPM's podcast, More Than a Game. Katya Mendoza wraps up the episode by introducing us to a Tucson baseball legend.
The thing about being a hometown hero in the world of baseball is that because Latinos have changed the sounds, sights, and tastes of the game, from ethnic foods like Sonoran hot dogs to walk-up songs using mariachi or reggaeton, baseball has historically presented itself as a vehicle for change. And Eddie Leon's story exemplifies just that.
I was born in Barrio Hollywood. I attended what is now Manzo Elementary School, went to John Spring Junior High, 4 years at Tucson High School, graduated in 1963. I was a couple years younger than my classmates, and I graduated from high school at 16.
During his years as a Badger, Eddie played under Ray Adkins, a former professional baseball player who played for the New York Giants. Adkins led Tucson High to 2 state baseball championships and retired as the winningest coach in Arizona history in 1983. Adkins took over for Hank Slagle, a fellow University of Arizona alum who was a member of Pop McHale's all-time baseball team. Slagle coached Tucson High to 10 state baseball championships. Talking about his teammates from Tucson High, Eddie says a majority were Latino.
There weren't that many other high schools there, so there was pretty good concentration. We had a big population at Tucson High as well, so you can imagine you had a lot of Latinos.
In 1963, Eddie's college career began.
Went to the University of Arizona for 4 years, graduated in 1968 with a degree in civil engineering.
The U of A was a strong baseball program when he was there. He played for Frank Sansit, who took the team to 9 College World Series and retired as the second winningest coach at that time in 1972. After all, Eddie was a young teammate. He graduated from high school at just 16 years old.
Sansit said he wanted me to come to the university to play, but that I probably wouldn't be able to play full-time until I was a junior because Rich Shiat was going to be the 2-year starter ahead of me, and therefore he couldn't give me a scholarship.
And college rules from back in the day said he couldn't play varsity as a freshman.
But our freshman team had, we had 3 future All-American on that team, and we used to beat the varsity regularly as freshmen. So after my freshman year, I went to Sansit and I said, I think I need to have a full baseball scholarship. And he gave it to me.
Eddie was a 2-time All-American and Western Athletic Conference first team in 1966 and 1967.
We went to the World Series in 1966. We only played 3 games. We were eliminated. We played University of Texas, Northeastern, and Southern Cal.
A well-known competitor who played against Eddie was Reggie Jackson, who played for Arizona State University that same year. You know, Mr. October, Baseball Hall of Famer, 2-time World Series MVP who played more than 2 decades in the majors.
You know, I played against Reggie for 6 games that year, and then I've played against him when he was with the Oakland A's and I was with Cleveland. The year before, ASU had Sal Bando, Rick Mundy, Duffy Dyer, And I played against all of those in the major leagues as well as against them at ASU.
Eddie caught the eye of MLB recruiters early on. In 1965, he was drafted in the first round by the Minnesota Twins and again in 1966 by the Chicago Cubs, both of which he turned down.
After my freshman year, I wanted to sign with the Yankees. And I was going to sign with them after my sophomore year. But that year, 1965, Major League Baseball created the Major League Draft. And that was the first draft in 65. And the Yankees were not the top nine selectors. And I was taken in the first round as the number nine pick by the Minnesota Twins.
Eddie says that they didn't offer him much. Rick Monday, who was the number one pick for the Kansas City Athletics back then, had received over a $100,000 bonus.
The Twins offered me $7,500 as the second college player taken. I said, no, I don't think I'm going to sign.
Eddie says the next year was probably his best playing college ball. He was drafted number one by the Chicago Cubs.
And they were going to send me to AA. I think it was somewhere in the Texas League. That they wanted me to learn how to play third base or left field. And I told them that I didn't want to sign with them because they had Ron Sano as a third baseman and Billy Williams as a left fielder who was going to go through like 1,000 so many games consecutive played. And I said, if I'm a third baseman or left fielder with your team, I'll never get to play. So I want to continue to play short. And he said, no, we want to sign you and you want to play there. So I said, no, then I'm not signing.
And so Eddie returned to the U of A to play his senior season in 1967.
The Cleveland Indians drafted me then.
He went on to play 5 seasons with the team we now know as the Cleveland Guardians, then 2 seasons with the Chicago White Sox, and 1 with the New York Yankees, who released him in 1975.
That's a pretty tough thing to take. You've been playing baseball since you're 4 years old, playing professionally baseball and in the major leagues for 8 years. And then all of a sudden they said, we don't have room for you on the team anymore. We're releasing you. And all of a sudden you say, wait a minute, what happened here? I've been doing this forever. Now I don't have this job anymore. So it's a shock. Especially, you know, when you think you're 30, 31 years old, you still can play. And all of a sudden they say, no, you can't play anymore.
So he headed to Mexico.
I played a couple years in Mexico in the Summer Mexican League with Tampico. And in the Mexican Pacific League in the winter with the Naranjeros from Hermosillo.
His first year, Los Alijadores de Tampico, the Tampico Lightermen, finished first in the league's Northeast Division.
We ended up being the national champions, and there were 32 teams in the league, so it was a pretty good accomplishment for the Tampico Alijadores.
It probably helped that he wasn't the only former MLB player on the team. He played with Tom Silverio, Joe Pactua, and Denny O'Toole. During his time with the Naranjeros de Hermosillo, or Hermosillo Orange Growers, the team won the Mexican Pacific League playoff in 1975.
And earned the right to go to the Caribbean World Series, which that year was held in Santo Domingo, the Dominican Republic.
The Naranjeros became the first Mexican team to win the Caribbean World Series in 1976. That same year, Eddie would retire from playing professional baseball. During our interview, I happened to pull out a few photos of him from the desert, the U of A's yearbook in 1967.
Yeah, number 11.
He had never seen this one before.
This probably was not my senior year. Because this was in Bear Down Field on Cherry Street, which is now the library, I guess. It was right outside of Bear Down Gym, the baseball field was, and I can remember that scoreboard right there.
Eddie would return to the U of A years later for an exhibition game. In 1978, the school asked him to put together a team of pros from around Tucson for a benefit game against the Wildcats at High Corbett Field.
They called it the Eddie Leon All-Stars against the University of Arizona.
Jerry Kindall was the U of A coach at the time. And on the U of A lineup was a young Terry Francona.
Many years later, I find out from Terry, who's a very, very good friend of mine. He said that he called his dad, Tito Francona, another great baseball player. He called him after the game and he said, "Hey, Dad, do you realize I just played against six pro players that were down here at Arizona to play against us?"
Francona helped lead the Wildcats to the 1980 College World Series National Championship and was voted as the series' most outstanding player and enjoyed a long career with the MLB as a player and manager. That exhibition game was about 2 years after Eddie's retirement. In over 600 games across 8 seasons with the MLB, Eddie finished with over 400 hits and nearly 2,000 at-bats. He had 165 runs, 24 home runs, and 159 runs batted in. And after many years of being on the road,
well, I decided I think I've had enough. You've reached your pinnacle of your industry. When you're a starting shortstop in the major leagues, there's only 30 of them in the world doing that. That's something to have an honor of doing that, because not too many people can do that. And then in Mexico, I had a lot of success there because we won a couple championships, even though I didn't really enjoy the environment there. I did get to go to a lot of different Mexican cities. And so I got to know Mexico, and I got to know the culture and to speak the language for 2 full years. And so I'm even though I didn't really enjoy the environment, I did enjoy playing there just because of the experience that I got.
I first heard about Eddie's story from a traveling Smithsonian exhibition that came to Tucson called Play Ball in the Barrios and the Big Leagues. The bilingual showcase examined just how generations of Latinos have helped make the game what it is today, regardless of gender, race, and class. Eddie was approached by the Smithsonian to submit photos and personal artifacts for the display. In one photo, he's wearing a Minnesota Twins hat and a Naranjeros uniform.
That's a funny story on that one. This was when I was playing, I don't remember who I was playing with, probably my right after my last year with the Yankees, because I've got a Naranjeros uniform on, and I played with the Naranjeros just after that. And for some reason, I have a Twin Cities hat, the Twins hat. I don't know how I got that on there.
I asked him in hindsight how he felt about being asked to participate in the Smithsonian's exhibit and about Latinos' place in baseball. He said it's been an honor.
Well, they have a passion for it. I saw it when I went to Venezuela to play there. I saw it certainly in Mexico, in Hermosillo especially, and then in Puerto Rico, of course, they love Roberto Clemente, so they were all out, and then Dominican as well. But I felt it a lot this weekend on Sunday when I went up to the World Baseball Classic to watch USA get beat by Mexico. But there were 47,000 people in the stadium, and I would think 2/3 of them were Mexican. And they were draped in their flags and their Hermosillo Naranjeros uniforms and the Mexico jersey and hat. I mean, it was crazy. They just have a passion for baseball.
At last year's World Baseball Classic, Mexico's 11-5 victory over Team USA on March 12th drew a crowd of 47,534 people, an attendance record for any first-round game. Eddie says that all three of his sons played through high school and that he didn't feel a need to pressure them to play beyond. He says that they didn't show as much interest in the sport as he did until now.
Because we attend a lot of Major League games. When the Indians would have an alumni reunion in Cleveland, I went back for 3 straight years, and I took each one of them individually with me for 3 years, and they got to go play outfield in what was called Jacobs Field back then. Now it's Progressive Field.
In 2016, they went to the World Series, and in 2019, to the Cleveland All-Star Game.
All four of us, my three sons and I, are pretty good Cleveland Guardians fans now.
I asked Eddie, out of all the teams he played for, which was his favorite?
Professionally, probably the Indians, because I played every day, and I was there for 5 years. My idol was Mickey Mantle, and I always wanted to play shortstop for the Yankees. But unfortunately, I played very few games with the Yankees. I got to play shortstop. I realized my dream, but I didn't last very long with them. So, I mean, I loved New York, and I also liked very much so the White Sox because I was playing every day there also. But I think Cleveland, just because I was there for 5 years and I was pretty much a mainstay of the team. University of Arizona was great for me for 4 years, and Tucson High was too, you know. So every level that I played in, I really enjoyed.
Last season, we talked about just how connected baseball is to Southern Arizona and its reputation of consistently producing good players. Eddie says it's because the state has the weather, the fields, and tradition.
When I was going to the university, the best sport it had was baseball. And so it kind of filtered down to the high schools and junior highs and everything, and summer leagues. And I think it's just continued to grow that way, you know, the reputation and the ability to play good baseball in Southern Arizona has been there for a long, long time.
Closing out this season's opener for More Than a Game, I'm Katia Mendoza.
You can find More Than a Game wherever you get your podcasts. Episode 2 dropped earlier this week. That episode brings us two stories about mountain biking. And that's the buzz for this week. Tune in next week as we say farewell to a familiar sight in Southern Arizona skies. You can find all our episodes online at azpm.org and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Just search for The Buzz Arizona. We're also on the NPR app. Zach Ziegler is our producer. He's also the producer of More Than a Game. Our music is by Enter the Haggis. I'm Christopher Conover. Thanks for listening.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.